Welcome back to Donor Brass Stacks. The chat is quite virulent today. Peter, I think Lily was referring to comments made from Mr. Nasser, some of which were very strong views expressed regarding how black people relate to in life and business. I want to thank you, ma'am, for that clarification. I know Nasser well, Mr. Nasser, and I know his views regarding black people. It's important, though, that he's never had a conversation like that with me. But I have heard him expressing similar views, and it's now useful to know what you're talking about, because I had no sense that he was the reason for saying that. Nasser has had some interesting experience in business, and he seems to feel that he's been hard done by black people. I do, however, agree with the lady's comments that comments like this are not useful, they're not helpful. I believe in a post-racial world in many ways, and I think that as time passes, we move beyond race and we move towards an appreciation that human beings are no different. And I think that the vast majority of us hold on to those views. It's an interesting perspective, but in many ways, racial discrimination is heavily rooted in economic reality. So people tend to have those views in situations where there's an economic benefit to be derived. And that's what slavery was all about. That's the postulation that was made by Eric Williams. But I still don't believe that people are inherently racist. And I think suggestions of that are entirely unhelpful, as the lady was saying. But thanks for making that clarification. Peter, looking at Region 4 votes from 2011 to 2020, data is a 489 additional votes for the party in power expected compared to the PPP increase of 1,000. Region 4 is 43% of all votes, and the ruling party really only has two real strongholds, Region 10 and Region 4. It's difficult to look at Guyana like other CARICOM regions. Voting is based on race and other factors are minor. Thank you for that. Peter, you're blatantly disrespectful to Mr. Callender. Yeah, well, that's nothing new. I'll read another one. The region's significance is that it reps your strongest base. Yeah, okay. If the support you receive of the number of votes determine the allocation of seats, no wonder Jagdeo wants to say he has an increased number of votes in Region 4. Well, yeah, of course, because it is important. Peter, everyone says that. Okay, I guess we're talking about the comments about race. All right, let's find out what I'm going to read. Peter, by way of intro, let me say that I'm a mixed race Guyanese. I'm married to a black woman for the last 35 years. I have no racial bias. Now to Guyana, the ethnic divide was started by the USA and CIA in 1961 for their own foreign policy benefit. The CIA pitted a racial divide between Burnham and Jagan, which has festered unchecked ever since. Before the CIA interference, all races lived in peace and harmony. The ethnic divide is not a recent phenomenon, as some are suggesting. No political leader or party has done anything to foster ethnic healing. Rather, politicians have manipulated the race card for their own benefit. Listening to comments on the radio and social media, it appears that it is only Indians that are the racial ones. No comment from me on that. Down to Brass Stacks, good morning. Good morning and welcome. Good morning and welcome. 434-1790, the number you can call. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Peter.
Hey, morning, sir. How are you doing?
Okay, fine. What is your take on the new format for the presentation of estimates in Barbados?
You want to identify yourself, sir? Are you doing?
Pardon me?
Would you like to identify yourself?
Well, you could call me a social advocate.
Okay. No, I thought I recognized the voice. So I just wondered whether you want to identify yourself. Anyhow, you don't have to. No problem. So I like the format. I think I said that last time. I do like the one could argue it's an informality that allows for an interrogation of the individual ministers with the support of members of their staff. In the past, those members would come to Parliament and just sit. I like the fact that you can actually speak to a permanent secretary, call on them directly, because ultimately they're the main drivers of policy in government. So I support it. I like it.
What is the role of the civil servant and the role of the minister in the Westminster form of government?
My understanding is that the civil service is there to support the minister's policy direction.
I thought the minister was supposed to chart the course and the civil servants.
Support it.
Carry it out.
Right, support it, yeah.
So with these two entities sitting in Parliament, isn't there a blurring of the roles that they play?
I don't think so. Because if I say to you, our policy is that we want to increase the number of people in primary school by 50%. Okay? If a minister gives that broad instruction, we need to increase the number of primary school places by 50%. The permanent secretary has substantial discretion in determining how exactly that instruction is executed. And I think this approach gives us the opportunity to ask the minister to justify the increases in primary school places, and then to ask the permanent secretary, how exactly do they plan to execute this? And you know, how will they make it happen? What are the resources that are needed? What is the support that is needed across the board, and how will they make it happen?
But in some of these debates, mm-hmm. I see the civil servants are taking a major role.
Right.
So does the minister really command his ministry?
I understand your concern because in many instances the issues are technical. And once you have a technical conversation, unfortunately, the minister has to take back seat. If, let's say, for example, the policy decision is taken to construct a roundabout in Eden Lodge, okay?
Yeah.
The minister makes that decision and says, we want a roundabout in Eden Lodge. However, the permanent secretary and the chief technical officers are in a position to say how big, how wide, how high, what disruption is necessary and what not. These are things that a minister cannot respond to. So if you, for example, have an impression that the roundabout is too big and it should be smaller, and that's your main concern as a parliamentary representative for Eden Lodge, you feel that it should be a smaller roundabout, the only person that can respond and engage you in that debate is the technical officer. And he will have to give you reasons as to why it can't be no bigger.
I think
what is concerning you is the fact that a number of the conversations that you have seen over the past few days are extremely technical, and you don't like the sight of a technical officer or a permanent secretary responding to a politician's questions. That's what bothers you.
It's not what bothers me. I just see that as a blurring of the roles that two entities are supposed to be performing.
Just be clear, though, that in many instances, what they're responding to is not whether or not a policy is the policy. What they're responding to is the implementation of the policy. And in relation to education, in relation to health, a number of the issues are entirely technical. And I mean, if the minister is a doctor or not, it doesn't matter. But he's not really in a position to respond to many of those technical issues. Let's say, for example, what is your specialization? What do you do for a living? Or what is your specialization?
I was a teacher. I retired now.
Okay. So let's say, for example, the issue related to teaching in which you have some specialty, right? Within the American system, Congress can subpoena you to come to give evidence before Congress regarding the execution of policy in which you may have superior knowledge. And you would have to go to Congress and respond directly to questions that they will ask. We seem to be adopting a similar style, whereby you can be brought before Parliament, sit in the well, and be asked questions and asked to respond because you have a superior knowledge in relation to these issues. It's not that you are being brought to challenge government policy. You're being brought to explain how better it can be done. And I think that that's progress, that's substantial progress, because ultimately the public servants work for you. They don't work for themselves, they work for you. You don't agree?
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah. So, what signals do you think the Minister of Education is sending?
By way of what? This 11 plus?
Yeah, by 11 plus, so she has backtracked now on saying that she didn't say this was to be the last year.
But because y'all probably, all of you so probably get to her and tell her don't think that it ain't a good idea, and you know. It's hard, you know, sir. Anytime you go and slaughter a sacred cow, it can be hard. Because everybody in the village is going to be telling you, man, don't slaughter it, or don't slaughter it, no, slaughter it next year.
So how come she is a minister and she doesn't want to make any hard decisions?
But I think she has made a hard decision, but the problem is that...
The Prime Minister has now to come and solve this problem?
No, I ain't going on that road.
Prime Minister
has to pronounce on it? Sir, as I said to you just now, when you are... You know, you're familiar with Hindu culture? Right?
Yeah.
Cows are sacred, all right? But there are some villages in which you just have too many cows. So they're destroying the crops, they're walking all over the place, but the cows are sacred. Anytime you want to slaughter one of these cows, it's not going to be popular. There are several good reasons why the cow, which is called 11 plus, should be slaughtered. The problem is that when you actually attempt to put the knife to its throat, everyone is going to tell you, well, don't do it now. Maybe tomorrow, maybe next week. And as a minister, then you get into a negotiation as to when this cow will be slaughtered, even though we ultimately agree that it will be slaughtered. And my sense was that Santia put down her foot and said, it will be slaughtered this year, full stop. Sorry, it will be slaughtered next year, full stop. But she introduced the opportunity for a negotiation as to when it is slaughtered, what we replace it with, and whatnot. My sense is that the pressure has been extreme in terms of, especially in the technical capacity, people saying, don't slaughter it now, slaughter it later. So maybe that's what she has succumbed to. I don't know. I haven't discussed it with her, and I haven't had the opportunity to interrogate the reasons why. I personally believe that she took the right decision in saying it done in this year.
Well, having said that, she did not put anything on the table for people to discuss.
She said there is an opportunity for you now to discuss a replacement.
But she should have placed something.
No. She said the cow is dying. You can discuss whether you're going to go with tofu or whether you're going to go with soya or whatever replacement you want to go with, but the cow is dying. The problem you're saying is that you believe she should have said, okay, no beef, soya is on the menu.
And so on before we arrive at the final product.
But suppose I don't like soya.
And there was nothing there on the table.
But sir, suppose I don't like soya. If she comes to me and she says, no beef, soya, and I don't like soya.
But she's not only saying no beef, soya. She's saying soya, but we are going to treat this thing to become something that the majority of people flavor.
Sir, she said no beef. We can determine what else is on the menu. And we have several options. We have fish, we have chicken, we have soya, we have tofu. You can determine which one you prefer.
That's where the problem arose. Well, because she placed nothing.
But no, but she did. She said that there are several options. She said you can go full zone it.
But she never gave one.
Because
we're going to treat it because we arrive at something that the majority are in favor of.
You know that she's a vegetarian, right?
I don't know. I don't know about her.
She's a vegetarian. So I didn't say that her preference may be for a non-meat option, right? It's just that she appreciates that the vast majority of us are not like her, and maybe some people may want chicken. So her thing is, let me not color the conversation by saying we are going in a direction. Let us leave it open and give people the opportunity to say, you can pretty much have anything on the menu, however, beef is off the menu. And I think that that's a progressive position to take. If it was me, it would be different. But then maybe that's why I'm not a politician.
But I spoke to you about this issue already, and I
probably
told you that her pronouncement that the exam was going to end this year, that threw the whole educational system in a confusion. Mm-hmm. Because the people who were going to take the exam next year, they don't have anything now to aim at. So there were people going to school just for the sake of going to school then. But the whole primary school program is geared towards the common entrance.
And that's the problem, because the whole primary school program ought to be geared for equipping young people to make a contribution to this country and to help them understand and identify where their strengths and weaknesses are, like the good Lord intended. That's what primary school should be about. Primary school should be about preparing for no exam. Primary school should be about preparing a child for...
That's for government primary schools.
What are you talking about?
Private primary schools, they have all types of programs.
Right, and certainly government primary schools should have the option to have all types of programs too, simply because primary schools should be about preparing a child and giving it the foundation it needs for life. But we have consumed primary school with preparing for an exam.
Determine the program.
So, sir, if as a result of not having this burden of an 11 plus, primary schools can start doing languages and they can start doing this, what is called as Montessori method, where children study all different kinds of things and play more and whatnot, they would be glad. I would be glad. There's nothing wrong with that. So don't feel as though they're wasting their time. They're not wasting their time. You're doing what primary school should always have been about, learning. And not learning for an exam, but learning for life.
I'm saying that New Orleans and the government primary school would have been wasting their time.
I disagree with you, sir.
Are geared towards 11 plus. These programs are not geared towards life or anything.
And sir, and that's why your admission just now, to me, is the root of the problem. What you need to do, sir, now is as an educator, you need to help contribute to a reevaluation of the curriculum in the primary school away from this exam and towards the important thing that children need to learn. So, for example, if you feel that children need to learn to wash their hands properly, then you will be teaching them that in primary school.
I have given you my suggestions already about
when I was in primary school, one of the things that Ms. Maxwell taught us was how to eat with a knife and fork. Right? If you think that is important in primary school, then you will have lessons in that. You get my point?
Yeah, I get your point.
Food and nutrition, in terms of what is the important thing to eat and not to eat, in terms of a balanced diet, in terms of not littering. All of these are things that you should perhaps be learning in primary school. Those are important skills. So maybe you have time for all of that? No. You know? My friend Sandy like religious education and thing. I personally don't have a lot of time for it, but maybe then you'll have time for more religious education if you ain't got an 11 plus. Y'all could teach children about the Bible and the Quran and the Bhagavad Gita and all of them things. For better or worse, is the case maybe. Final words, sir. We're going to have to run. Go ahead.
Yeah, man. All right, thanks a lot, man.
All right. Good chatting with you, sir. I hope that we get a chance to interact some more. All right. Take care. This is Down to Brass Tacks. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Down to Brass Tacks. I have some WhatsApp messages I want to read. This first person says, Peter, I love the way you handle this confident entrance exam. It reminds me of this. And he sends me a clip that starts, Einstein once said everybody's a genius. However, if you judge a fish by its ability to climb a tree, that fish will spend its whole life believing it is stupid. And of course it continues, but I think you get the point that is being made. Good morning, Mr. Peter. This is my take on the matter in Guyana. The APNU is a very weak government, a one-seat majority which equals to 6,000 votes. You have to take into consideration there are 9 small parties contesting the election. 2, the APNU did not do a lot of groundwork to ensure that their supporters were registered to vote. 3, the PPP made inroads into the APNU support through the candidates. 4, a new prime ministerial candidate has brought some votes from the disciplinary forces. There are videos circulating on social media why some APNU supporters did not vote in Region 4. So there's doubt in my mind that the PPP has won the election fair and square. The PPP has placed a statement of polls on a website for Guyanese to view for themselves. The APNU has not done that. If you are claiming that you have won, why not prove it? The statement of polls for Region 4. I certainly agree with you, sir, that if it is that you have won it fair and square, let's have the statement of polls, publish them, and let's see what exactly it is that you have based your claim on. And I think that that is the fundamental error that we are having. The other thing which the data has revealed, which you, sir, may have been considering, is that there was a swing away from the PPP, from the APNU AFC group. However, that swing did not always materialize in support for the PPP Civic, which suggests to me that the small parties may have taken away support from the APNU AFC. Simply put, this 6,000 vote lead that you had in the previous election, and I agree that it was slim, has been eroded not necessarily by people who wanted to vote for the PPP, but people who may have disagreed with you, but didn't necessarily want the other people. So if I look at the GCOM formulation, which is the GCOM's own admission in relation to what happened, you have a situation where the APNU is said to have gained 1%. Sorry, the APNU is said to have lost 0.04% of the support, while the PPP Civic is said to have lost a full 1% of its support, which says to me that there is a disequilibrium, meaning that more people are moving away from you, more or less towards the other person. And the third parties in this picture, which we are not taking into consideration, essentially respond to the difference. And this says to me that there are some challenges regarding the tenure of the APNU AFC and the extent to which they have been able to enhance and increase their vote support. You would recall that I did a poll about a year ago, And that poll had shown that in 4 years, the status quo essentially remained the same in terms of the outcome. Ironically, that poll is very similar to the outcome that we're seeing today, which is being suggested by GCOM that the status quo has been retained with a limited swing away from the APNU. My sense, and I think this is what the caller is saying, if in 4 years, after being out of office for 25 years, you can't increase your support significantly across the country, you have a problem. Dr. Brastatz, good morning. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir. How are you doing?
Fine.
Good.
Now, this month is the month of the disabled.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to salute the disabled community in Barbados. I believe that things need to happen. Enable the disabled to be enabled in terms of traversing the streets, in terms of making the prerequisite changes to make the disabled more comfortable in whatever they do, how they go about this country.
Yeah. I like that phrase a lot. We have to enable the disabled.
Yeah.
That's a nice slogan.
I'm a representative of the Wheelchair Foundation of Barbados. You might not have heard about it.
I haven't, no.
We have been now in business for the foundation. Will be 15 years old on the 12th of March. And it fits neatly into the month of the disabled.
Mm-hmm.
When we look at the whole question of the NDCs, which is non-communicable diseases in Barbados, one would recognize, especially if you look at Cuba, who don't, as far as I understand, I've gone to Cuba several times, they do not amputate your feet. They have, they try to treat to make sure you have your limbs, all your limbs intact. And we were called the capital of the world for cutting off people's limbs.
You said that they check to see if you have all your limbs intact?
Well, that's what happens. But
okay.
My biggest point here is that the Wheelchair Foundation in Barbados have enabled several thousand people. Indeed, we have given away 1,540 wheelchairs to people across Barbados who suffered amputations, strokes, and various other types of complaints that they could not, and the doctors who give them the letter to say that they need wheelchair facility of a wheelchair or walker. We have been on the forefront of dealing with those activities to enable those persons to have upward mobility and have mobility in terms of moving around their homes and moving around the various communities across Barbados. 1,540 wheelchairs in 15 years. And those wheelchairs are given to those people FREE, free of cost.
Mm.
Free of cost. And we think that more and more an organization like ours need the support from the general public. Because, you see, there's an old saying which goes, what ain't catch ya, ain't pass ya.
Mm.
You know that one, right?
Yeah.
Today you might be good and sitting in the studio properly and talking. Tomorrow you may not be. Something might happen that will cause you to say, I need to have that mobility. Because the NDCs are rampant in Barbados.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. A lot of us that come into this world able, leave the world disabled.
Exactly.
Or halfway through, we become disabled.
Diabetes
is a major disabler, one could argue. So you're saying that your organization is responsible for, your mission is really to raise funds to buy wheelchairs and distribute them.
Yeah, we raise funds all we can. It started when someone was in Miami, and a guy from the United States Wheelchair Foundation came up to him and said, are you from Barbados? And the person said, yes.
Mm-hmm.
They started the Wheelchair Foundation in Barbados, and that's the whole part of us in a way to facilitate us in getting the wheelchairs in Barbados. But we in Barbados need to, persons in Barbados need to contribute to the Wheelchair Foundation to provide that upward mobility in this country for persons who really are in dire need and cannot afford to purchase a wheelchair.
Okay.
And that is our mandate.
That's an excellent and important mission. And I believe, so do you do any advocacy regarding wheelchair use, like sidewalks and so on, or that's not part of your remit?
That's something we're moving to now, because we are also members of the, we also have a affiliation to the disabled organization,
yeah.
And they are more on that, but we are making sure that we go get that done.
Okay.
I can remember having a story where the good Matt Fingo went down through Broad Street with a wheelchair, and he was wondering to know how people could manage.
Yeah, yeah. I remember the Nation did something like that 2 years ago.
Yeah.
One thing, though, and I mean, I think that you need to continue to advocate for better sidewalks, wider sidewalks, sidewalks that are wheelchair accessible and so on. And I think that's an important thing that you need to do. There are also, outside of wheelchair use, there are other issues with disability that we could probably chat about, too. I noticed recently I was in Eagle Hall, and there was a guy in a wheelchair that was in a line of traffic. I was driving behind him. And it was struck because he was a motorized wheelchair, and it was moving at a fairly brisk clip, so it wasn't that he was holding back traffic or anything. The problem is that his wheelchair did not have one of these long poles at the back that with a yellow. With the best of intentions, I saw him, but I think that when I overtook him, the person behind did not, and I noticed there was a bit of swerving and so on. And I think with the best of intentions, it's hard to see a motorized wheelchair on the road because it is so much lower. A lot of us are driving SUVs these days. People like Dennis and so on, not people like me that can't afford it. But, you know, when you're all the way up there looking down on humanity, it's hard to see, you know, somebody in a wheelchair. So one of the things I would encourage you to advocate for is that when persons, especially motorized wheelchairs, when you're on the road and you're forced not to use a sidewalk, but you're forced to use the actual paved road, which is sometimes the only option that you have, you know, you need to have a visible indicator. And I've seen them in other parts of the world where the same thing happens. Persons have a visible indicator that is tall and an orange that allows the driver to be able to see you so that they can take the necessary action. But I want to commend you.
On the sidewalks in Barbados, you don't even know where you're coming to the other cross street. I noticed that in my travel, I've seen that there are, when the visually impaired person is getting towards a junction, there are some like bumps in the road, bumps on that part of the sidewalk, so you can know where you rub your cane across it. You know that is a point that you have to now step into, step down. I'll keep flowing.
Right.
I saw them all across Australia, all over England, those kind of places. So I think that we need, and not only to put the slope there, but also to indicate some kind of similar things to what they do overseas, to make sure that the visually impaired person is knowledgeable of where they're going. There's lots of things that need to be done to assist the disabled in this community, and I pray to God that one day coming soon that we will really come to grips with all these challenges and make sure that that we accept the disabled as people too.
No, and I am supportive. Sir, I've always been very supportive of the disabled community, and I wish you well in your mission. It's not going to be an easy one, for sure. And I will do whatever I can, certainly from this podium, to assist and facilitate the work that you're doing. It's excellent and important work. I do hope that I will not be needing a wheelchair in a hurry. However, the reality is that I could easily be in a situation where I do. And I would hope that at that point in time that, you know, people would want to respond to me in a way that I feel we should respond to them now. So 100% support from me, sir. I'm sorry?
We look forward to your contribution.
Okay. All right, sir. Thanks for calling. Good to hear from you, and all the best in the Month for the Disabled. I actually did not realize it was Month for the Disabled. I thought it was the month, well, it was certainly International Women's Day just passed. And let me take the opportunity to congratulate all the ladies out there, powerful women, on the occasion of International Women's Day.